end of chapter 38. So if you'll turn there, please, chapter 38, and we'll get into 39 this morning. As we, again, begin to get back into the time that we have here with the Lord questioning Job, we're going to look at the second part of his questioning, and even then he will not be finished. There were multiple questions that God asked Job. Somebody counted them. I don't know if that's quite as important, but there are multiple questions that someone asked, that God asked Job. The first one is, where were you there? Were you there? Were you there when I engineered the dimensions of the earth and determined its structure and then put it in place? Were you there when I set limits on and determined the boundaries of the seas? Now, again, that's the chapter 38 is what we're talking about. Then he asked, have you ever ordered the sun to rise just one time? Now, at that point, the Lord drew a parallel between the natural light and darkness and spiritual light and darkness. And one of the things that he talked about was, it's just like the sun rises and then you begin to see everything, right? And it makes everything clear. Light comes into a situation and it drives out the deeds of darkness. People don't want to be in the light. They'd rather be under the cover of darkness. He asked, have you searched the ocean's depths and the regions of darkness? And the Lord drew again a parallel to the darkness and the mystery of the depths, to the sea, of the sea, to death and the grave. So in both of these situations, there was a little bit of a spiritual aspect to it. Then he asked Job a series of questions that were, did you know? Did you know the origin? Do you know, the origin of light and darkness? Do you know the origin of light and darkness? Do you know where the snow and the hail are stored? Right, these are big, vast types of things. But you notice that sometimes it kind of flexes back and forth a little bit. Then he asks him, are you able to? Are you able to do certain things? Are you able to distribute the rain when and where it is needed? And possibly even keep it from different places. Are you able to direct the lightning? Are you able to make it warm or cold and change the forms of precipitation? Are you able to guide the stars and the constellations? All of these questions were based upon God's first question, which I waited to the end here because it's going to be a good transition to the message. God appeared to Job in what we would call like a tornado, this swirling wind. And so here is Job, and yes, his friends were there, but God was speaking specifically to Job, who is probably still sitting in his ashes, right, on the ash heap, is watching this storm come toward him and stop. And then God, who is even greater, obviously, than this amazing sight that he has, speaks to him out of the storm. And so out of this chaotic, swirling storm, God makes his presence known and he speaks. And he asks the question, who are you? Who are you? Who are you who dims understanding through ignorance? And then he tells him, prepare yourself. I will ask the questions and you will answer me. Today we will see God continue with that questioning. And as we even consider that, let's not forget that in the very beginning of the book, capital L-O-R-D, the not Adonai as in small case, you know, Lord, but with all caps, that is the self-existent God, right? That is the name for God. And on top of that, that is also how he addressed himself when he made covenants with people. All right, so this is the all-powerful God, the self-existent God, but not the distant God. And that's where how we see him make himself known here. Just one other quick note. God is not coming to Job because Job had questions about God. And so God's like, oh, I guess I better answer him. No, this is a very gracious act. All right. The whole point is that he doesn't owe Job anything. So we go from the inanimate then to today to the animate creation, or the Lord over living things. As we begin that, the Lord transitioned from the inanimate, non-living things, those are parts of creation that don't have any life in themselves, to obviously those things that he created that we even looked at during our scripture reading that have life. As a reminder, I want us to turn to Romans chapter 1 for all of this, just to keep this in mind as we go through. Romans 1 verses 19 to 20, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, that's everything that's been created, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. And I apologize. The in them is people. All right. That it's all about what he has created. So we inherently, every person inherently knows that there is something, someone bigger, obviously, than themselves. That is not sufficient for salvation. Let's make that clear. And somehow we go through life and that gets suppressed in us and we get educated out of that sometimes, right? But ultimately what it comes down to is this. God has put an inherent knowledge in every person that he's there. And we see him, not himself in the creation, but we see him through the creation. All right? So now what I want to do is read this passage that we're going to be looking at here. And it's a little bit lengthy, but it's important for us to get this context here and to see what he's saying. And we start at the end of Job 38. The end of Job 38, starting in verse 39. A little over 30 verses. And then we're going to examine these things. And even as you're turning there, I just want to make a note here. You know, we might even be asking ourselves, why we're talking about planets and we're talking about rain and we're talking about animals. You know, is this what we want to do on a Sunday morning? And the way I would answer that is, God is the one who's speaking here. And so, you know, this is not an exercise in futility. This is not some empty words here. This is God conveying some things, and we need to keep that in mind. And I think that it's going to help us. It's going to enhance us getting beyond the walls that we live in and the life that we lead and everything else to just simply stop and look up and look around and be reminded that, yes, creation is not God, but creation expresses very loudly who God is. So let me read these passages for you, beginning in chapter 30, verse 39 of chapter 38. Can you hunt the prey of the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lurk in their lairs to lie in wait? Who provides food for the raven when its young ones cry to God and wander about for lack of food? Do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear young? Or can you mark when the deer gives birth? Can you number the months that they fulfill? Or do you know the time when they bear young? They bow down, they bring forth their young, they deliver their offspring, their young ones are healthy. They grow strong with grain, and they depart and do not return to them. Who set the wild donkey free? Who loosed the bonds of the... It's Onager, but that is another name for donkey. Whose home have I made the wilderness and the barren land his dwelling? He scorns the tumult of the city. He does not heed the shouts of the driver. The range of the mountains is his pasture, and he searches after every green thing. Will the wild ox be willing to serve you? Will he bed by your manger? Can you bind the wild ox in the furrow with ropes, or will he plow the valleys behind you? Will you trust him because his strength is great, or will you leave your labor to him? Will you trust him to bring home your grain and gather it to your threshing floor? The wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are her wings and pinions like the kindly stork's? For she leaves her eggs on the ground and warms them in the dust. She forgets that a foot may crush them or that a wild beast may break them. She treats her young harshly as though they were not hers, and her labor is in vain without concern. Because God deprived her of wisdom and did not endow her with understanding. And when she lifts herself on high, she scorns the horse and the rider. Have you given the horse strength? Have you clothed the neck with thunder? Can you frighten him like a locust? His majestic snorting strikes terror. His paws in the valley, he paws in the valley, rejoices in his strength. He gallops into the clash of arms. He mocks at fear and is not frightened, nor does he turn back from the sword. The quiver rattles against him and the glittering spear and javelin. He devours the distance with fierceness and rage. Nor does he stand firm because the trumpet has sounded. At the blast of the trumpet, he says, "Aha!" He smells the battle from afar, the thunder of captains and shouting. Does the hawk fly by your wisdom and spread its wings toward the south? Does the eagle mount up at your command and make its nest on high? It dwells on the rock and resides on the crag of the rock, the stronghold. From there it spies out the prey, and its eyes observe from afar. Its young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there it is. A lot going on here, and we're going to take it piece by piece. But the first thing we're going to ask ourselves is, when it comes to the Lord is, do you provide for the predators? That's the question that he asks Job. I'm generalizing. God asked, do you provide for the predators? And we can see here is he asked, you know, can you satisfy the appetite of the young lions? Do you provide food for the raven? We'll get to the raven in just a moment. But when it comes to the lions, you know, it's kind of fun to do a little bit of research. It's a little different than normal. Lions need a minimum average of 12 to 20 pounds of meat per day. That sounds like a fun diet, doesn't it? A male lion can eat up to 88 pounds of meat at one time. Yeah. Some of you, you're a snack. For some of us, we're a large meal. Anyway, so some advice. Don't ask a lion over for your cookout, okay? I just did a little bit of math. Basically, with a sirloin steak on sale today, it would cost you $500, roughly, to have a lion over for dinner. Okay? Now, you might ask yourself, why did you say that? What did the Lord challenge Job with? He asked him, are you going to hunt and provide for the lions? And my point is, how long would it take you before you couldn't even provide for a lion out of your own resources at $500+ a day? If you want a hamburger, it'd be a little cheaper. But you get my point. He's saying, is this possible for you? Job could not even hunt enough wild animals to feed one lion. And God takes credit for them all. And I'm sorry I missed our lovely picture here. But we're going to move forward with the raven. Why would God tack on the raven? I think part of it is showing the variety of his creation, and he'll continue to do that. But ravens often nest in high and secluded areas, like tall trees or even cliff faces, as you can see. Part of God's question had to do with providing for the young. So in essence, the Lord asked Job if he was going to deliver food to extreme locations. Can you do that? I'll put it in our vernacular today. Can you be DoorDash for the ravens? That's what God's asking. You going to deliver? Within God's first example of hunters, there is a secondary theme of life and death. God provides for the young of the lion and the raven. For those creatures to survive, other creatures have to die. They're carnivores, for the most part. Now, we prefer to shy away from those rather grim realities. Who doesn't root for the gazelle when it's running from the cheetah, right? I mean, we're all like, oh, you can make it, you can make it, you know. Yes! Or, oh, not so good, right? We cringe when we see a documentary and the pack of wolves separates the young elk from the herd, right? Now, if you don't, it's okay to root for the predator, but there's a certain point where we might have to talk, right? You can't go too far with that, right? But rather than shy away from the harsh realities of fallen creation, the Lord exalts His all-powerful control. He explains, I'm in control of all of this. This is all under me. And I am feeding the needs of part of my creation. Just to kind of help us understand a little bit, this is actually a picture I got in Alaska, so you can see the difference between an eagle and a raven. Raven's a big bird, and they prey on anything and everything they can. They're very opportunistic, sometimes even carrion, other dead things. But the point is that God provides for all that they need, and He provides for their young, that emphasis with the lions and with the ravens. But beyond that, he then asked the question, do you care for the mothers and the young? And I understand we've read this passage already, but I just want to highlight a couple of things here, right? He talks about the mountain goats, right? Do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear their young? Think about this for a minute. Think about the mountain goats. The Lord moved from one extreme to another, right? He moves from the predators to the prey in a lot of ways. In all these examples, God was moving Job from the safe, domesticated farm that he had. He had a giant estate, right? To the world of the wild animals. Unlike the safety of the farm where an animal would even be helped to give birth, there's no security or help for the wild. There's no one there for them, except God says, I am there. So he illustrated the mountain goat because of how inaccessible they are. And if you remember, he talked about how they're on these steep cliffs, right? So he asked Job, do you go through the steep mountains and make sure that all the pregnant and baby mountain goats are okay? And what's the underlying answer there? The underlying answer is, obviously, no, you don't, but I do. I do. He talks about the deer. The deer also give birth in the wild without any assistance. And this same all-powerful God who directs the sun and the moon and the stars, like we looked at last week, cares for baby animals. The Lord knows when and where each deer, antelope, sheep, etc., give birth to their young. And the message is, God determines when life comes forth. He determines it. And He's there. And we saw in that passage that we see them born healthy, grow up, and then go off to be, you know, eventually Bambi, right? He grew up and it was a large male deer that went out and was his own deer, I guess. I don't know. Sorry, I didn't really practice that part. Anyway, so let's move on here. Job then asked, can you tame the wild beast? Can you tame the wild beast? And there were two. The first one was a donkey, right? And this has to do with the freedom of wild animals. Who set the wild donkey free? Who loosed the bonds of the donkey, whose home I have made in the wilderness? And on it goes. We already read this part. But the point is this. The donkey is still today an important work animal in a lot of places on people's farms or in their fields. Job would have been very familiar with them because he had 500 female donkeys before they were taken away from him. These wild donkeys preferred desolate areas where they were content to wander, feeding on the scarce plants that they had around them. God made them free to choose where they wanted to roam. And they were not subject to people. That's where that we see that picture. He doesn't listen to the driver. In other words, there isn't somebody that's cracking the whip behind him saying, go here, go there. He goes where he wants. He's wild. He's not domesticated. And by the way, we think to ourselves, lions, things like that. I mean, like, they're not in the Middle East, are they? Aren't they relegated to certain parts of Africa? In ancient times, they were there. All these animals that we're talking about were in the Middle East. Okay? And there's more. But then he talks about the power and the danger of wild animals. Now, can this apply to lions? Absolutely. All right? God just simply was making a different point when he was talking about the lions. But now he's going to be talking about this wild ox. Will the wild ox be willing to serve you? Will he bed by your manger? Can you bind the wild ox with the furrow with the ropes? Or will he plow the valleys behind you? Right? The idea here is that as we think about this ox, again, Job owned 500 pair of plowing oxen. 500 pair. He had an estate. Each pair yoked together and guided by a plowman to break the ground in long furrows and prepare the earth for planting. That was their job. So domesticated all the way around, right? But the wild ox stands for nature's power and danger, as I mentioned. The Lord contrasted the domestic work animal to the wild oxen known as aurochs. These wild oxen measured 6 feet across from shoulder to shoulder. 6 feet across. David used wild bulls to represent his enemies. And that's what he was talking about. Job would have appreciated the strength of the animal and would have seen their benefit to his farm. That's what that last part of the passage is talking about. Wouldn't you like it if this animal was plowing for you? You'd get a lot more work done. This thing's a beast. But the truth is that animals like this have no desire to be tamed, and they can't be forced to have something tied to them and have them plow these nice, even rows. It isn't going to happen. They're very powerful, and their horns can wound or kill. By the way, you probably know this already, but in Africa, the Cape buffalo is actually the most dangerous animal in the continent. They're mean. They will tree a man for days. So again, not only is this how God made them, but he can and does control them. You can't, Job. I do. And not just one, not just a few that you might try to help with your farm, but I control them all. I believe he then, if we can kind of summarize, he asked Job another question. Do you give animals their character? Now, we've already seen some characteristics of different animals. But when we think about the ostrich, this is, do you give the ostrich its grace and simplicity? Its grace and simplicity. And we'll look at that as we work through this passage. But the first thing he says is the wings of the ostrich, this is 39 verses 13 through 16 eventually, the wings of the ostrich wave proudly. But are her wings and pinions like the kindly storks? Well, what's that talking about? It's talking about the fact that they can't fly. They look great. They don't do anything, right? So just a few tidbits about ostriches. They can weigh between 250 and 350 pounds. They look like little fluff balls, right? They're not. They can reach 9 feet tall. And again, although their feathers are beautiful, God made them flightless. And then it talks about the eggs of the ostrich. The eggs of the ostrich. The eggs in the nest pictured have probably at least three ostrich moms represented here. They often are communal nests, and they will have up to 40 eggs in them. I think there's about 30 in this picture that I have for you. So they lay their eggs in a simple scrape in the ground. And as you can see, it's not extremely organized, right? Because what does the passage say? Getting back to this again. She warms them in the dust after she lays them. She forgets and a foot may crush them or that a wild beast may break them. because of how they lay their eggs, it makes them vulnerable. It makes them vulnerable to predators and also to just being broken either by animals or even the ostrich themselves. And what's interesting is that if a couple of eggs are broken, if a few eggs are broken, they can abandon the whole nest. It somehow does something to them, and they look down and they see the broken ones. They're like, okay, I'm done with this. So you could have 30 plus more eggs that are just fine there, but they will leave them all. All right? This is part of what God said about treating her young harshly. Right? Because that's part of her young are those in egg form. Just abandons them. Ostriches will also run from their young when a predator approaches. They're supposed to be doing that to draw them away, but this also leaves the young ones without protection. Okay? So this is that whole simplicity that God is talking about in that little brain that's in that really big body. Now, some have even asked, why is the ostrich in here? You know, it's kind of the outlier. And I don't know if this is true or not. I didn't, like, look at this for confirmation. But according to one source, the Septuagint doesn't even put the ostrich in because of what it says. Wouldn't that be nice? I don't like this animal. I'll cross that out. But what's the point? God is talking about the extremes of characteristics of animals that he made. But even here, there is a redeeming quality. There's something that this animal does that sets it apart. And we see here in this passage, the end of this passage, God deprived her of wisdom and did not endow her with understanding, right? So that's part of it. This is the bird equivalent of an airhead, I guess. I don't know. But, you know, ostriches kind of do their thing and don't really know what they're doing sometimes. But look at what's next. When she lifts herself on high, she scorns the horse and rider. Well, okay, what does that mean? It has a limited capacity as far as what it knows, as far as, you know, the responsibilities that it takes and things like that. But it has strengths. The strength is its running. The ostrich can run 30 miles per hour for 30 minutes or more. They can sprint for 40 to 45 miles per hour and have bursts up to 60 miles an hour. So if anybody here was late to church, you were flying about the same as an ostrich runs. Okay, you were doing that, all right? And the reason why it talked about the horse is because really the top speed of a racehorse is a little over 40 miles an hour, and that can only be maintained for a short period of time. And a typical riding horse, obviously with a rider on top, has a top speed of about 20 to 30 miles an hour. So all of these things that make the ostrich seem silly and weird and almost useless, then God turns around and says, but I gave this baby legs, right? This thing can move, and it can move fast. So much so that, and again, we're using poetic language here. God is using poetic language. It laughs at the horse and rider. Can't keep up. He then really nicely transitions over into the horse. Do you give the war horse its courage? As we look at this, just to note a couple of things. Have you given the horse its strength? He mocks at fear and is not frightened, nor does he turn back. And just one other thing, it's interesting. It says that he devours the distance with fierceness and rage, talking about him going into battle. The idea is that through his hooves digging into the ground and him pushing forward toward the battle, he's eating the distance. That's an amazing picture, isn't it? I mean, he's excited to get into it. The horse has been a strategic part of war for thousands of years. Today we have mechanized warfare, right? We have tanks and artillery. It's interesting. The last American cavalry charge was in the Philippines in 1942. That's how recent we've actually used horses in warfare. Then the Lord here interweaves the strength of the horse with its bravery. The picture he gave was a fast, strong animal that fearlessly ran toward the battle. The noise of war, the swords, the shields, everything clanging together, the shouts of the commanders and the soldiers, all of this, you know, we call that like the din of war, right? All of this did not dissuade it at all. Even the arrows and the sword and the spears, the lances coming at the war horse, do not cause him to retreat in fear. So just as God can give one animal, the ostrich, really some silliness, it can give this very majestic horse extreme bravery. And by the way, the horse is not a hunter, right? The horse isn't going after prey. He then moves on, and again, he's spreading his knowledge and his control of all things as far as the different characters. He's spreading this out so that Job gets a good understanding, and we do as well. Do you give birds their unique abilities? Now, I will tell you, I've restrained myself here. I know you know I'm a bird watcher. I've shared a few things, but, you know, I'm not going crazy with this. So we're going to look through this passage beginning in verse 26. It says, "Does the hawk fly by your wisdom and spread its wings toward the south?" Folks, this is talking about migration, and it's just an amazing thing. And this is... probably we're talking about a smaller hawk. In our continent, this is the Cooper's hawk. The Cooper's hawk, he flies up north. He's obviously here as well and even in the south. But he flies up north, and there's a certain point when it gets cold, they fly back again. This is representative, really, of many kinds of birds. Not all hawks migrate, and not all hawks migrate like the Cooper's hawk. But one thing that's unique about the Cooper's hawk and other hawks like it is this. And this is a young one. The hatchlings, those who are hatched that year up somewhere in Canada, when they fly south first. How do they know? How do they know? I mean, we're not even talking about just how birds go back and forth and how they have an understanding of that and how they can be guided regardless of the weather, whether it's clouds or anything else, and then go back to the same places. We're talking about a little animal, a bird, that is hatched out and then one day just flies south without its parents. Now, I have these pictures here, and I want to add one more. Just something a little unique about birds, this particular one. The darker the eye, the older the bird is. So they know if they were to net a first-year bird because it has those light eyes. And so here they have the first wave that comes down are these birds that have the lighter eyes, not the dark red ones. And so they're netting them and they're weighing them and they're checking all this out. But the whole point is this: they know who comes first. Scientists. We were actually watching them band birds at one time. And this guy says, you know, we don't know how they know how to do this. Maggie says, I know. God tells them. Seriously. So then we move on. From the smaller hawk to the larger eagle, does the eagle mount up at your command and does its nest on the rocks it dwells and resides on the crag of the rock and the stronghold. And we're not going to talk about the nest just because we've already been there. But this has to do with the ability of the eagle to reach great heights, right? An eagle can fly upwards of 13,000 feet, and some say as high as 20,000 feet. But just to throw a little fun fact in here, there's a griffon vulture species that can fly 37,000 feet in the air. All right? We're talking jetliner height here, guys. It blows my mind, right? So they can fly really high. Great. I mean, that's an amazing characteristic. And we venerate the eagle because of that, right? They're this large, majestic bird that just soars up there. But there's another aspect to it. It says, from way up high, right? It spies out its prey. Its eyes observe from afar. So, eagles have been given by God a couple of different things that we don't have. One of them is binocular vision. They can focus each eye independently. And that helps them to be able to determine exactly where their prey is and how to get to it. This gives them extremely more accurate vision. They also have a much wider field of view because of where their eyes are on their heads, right? But they also have a sort of telescopic vision. Muscles in their eyes reshape their eyeballs. The eagle can clearly, so in other words, they can zoom in. All right? Wouldn't that be nice? Where's my car? Right? You zoom in. Wouldn't that be nice? That's what an eagle can do. But here's the crazy thing. They can clearly see a small mouse from 2 miles away. The larger the prey, the farther away they can be seen. Yeah. And so here's God saying, did you make them this way? Right? Did you design them? So he's asked him all of these questions about the created world. What was the purpose? Now, I will tell you, there is a bigger purpose that we have to wait a little bit to see. You might already know it, but we're going to preach through it soon. But the grand theme of God's questions to Job has to do with the Lord personally being in control of every aspect of his creation. Now, we can't overlook the obvious. We tried to make this abundantly clear. God created everything. He made it. He used a variety of both non-living and living things to show Job that nothing escapes his attention or is out of his control. For us, once we get beyond our safe places and into nature, we find a wild and in many ways a chaotic world full of danger and violence. Now, some of you understand that Maggie and I, were confronted just recently in Alaska with a bear close enough by to where it was more than scary. All right. So I can attest to the fact that you can step out there and everything's great until you're the prey. Okay. It's a crazy, very real feeling that can go over you. And the good thing is the feelings were just that. They didn't become actual physical feelings, right? Nothing attacked us. But it's interesting. I remember out birding one time with my dad. And a person actually said that we humans ought to be more like the animals. They were one of these, I don't want to say environmentalists, but they were one of these, you know, be one with nature, you know, all that kind of good stuff, right? And I'll just tell you that my dad said in a very nice way, you must be crazy. He didn't say that. Those are my words. But he went on to explain, do you understand the violence of nature? See, I'm just being blunt here, folks. We put human lions away in cages. When a human kills somebody, we punish them. You understand? We don't want to be like the animals. Now, I understand that we raise meat and other things like that, but it is violent out there. And it's harsh. And that is not what God wants it to be about. Through this entire section, God specifically described how he watched over and provided for the young. And this includes the young of the hunter and the hunted. So he doesn't differentiate between them. So in God's view of things, he's not rooting for one over the other like we might do. All right? He's providing for them all. And he's providing for all of the young as well. So what was the overall message to Job? He was helping Job understand, and through this we need to understand, that Job was small, finite, and weak compared to God. I mean, I was trying to give, you know, adjectives for this, right? I can't. Like, how can we measure ourselves compared to the God who just described himself here? Everything from moving the stars to making sure that that little fawn was born. And everything in between. This is an amazing God who is not detached as Job thought him in himself. And there is order, even though Job felt like he was seeing chaos because his life felt chaotic. And on we can go, and we'll get there a little bit later on. So he asks, you know, did Job make these different animals with their unique characteristics? Could he care for them, and could he care for their young? Any single point that God asked was to the extreme impossible for Job. I mean, he couldn't fulfill any of it. There's nothing he could do. So for Job, in reality, as God was asking these things, he was powerless. He was powerless. He may have managed a large estate, but Job had very little power or control over all that was around him. And that was the main lesson that God wanted him to understand. But part of that was, on the other hand, God had absolute power over everything. Everything. All of creation. Job had lost sight of this. And it had some deep consequences. He was really in a state of despair. If you remember in, I think it was chapter 3, he just wanted to die. Now we know that he was able to work through some of that, but he didn't lose all of it. Because he also began to question God, right? Even God's integrity. So what can we take away from this as far as, you know, this whole theme that we've been talking about in going through difficulties and in facing some of the things that we see as either overwhelming or threatening or whatever it might be? Let me just say this. Understanding and clinging to God's sovereignty, the fact that he is the supreme ruler over all things, is critical, folks, to serving him. And it's not even just knowing that. It's placing our daily faith, our confidence in who God is. And when we lose sight of that is when we can fall into some of these difficult situations to where we can even get to the point where we're rebelling. All right? Now, did God allow this? Yes, he did. God allows the lion to eat too. Now, I'm not equating that with allowing Satan to attack him, because ultimately, what was that attack about? It was about just as much God's integrity as it was Job's. Because God said, have you considered him? He's a faithful man. And what did Satan say? If you let me have him, he's going to curse you to your face. And he didn't. Now, a couple other things. Can we just briefly note how God approached Job? We can't lose sight of this. Just so that we get this out of the way. God did not come at him in the whirlwind and then destroy him. Now let me ask you something. Would this righteous, holy God have been any less righteous or holy if he would have destroyed him? No. Job said more than once, you have wronged me. I'm looking at my circumstances. I don't deserve this. You have wronged me. Now, it is beyond question, right, that Job, and that God is putting Job in his place. He's definitely doing that. He is showing Job very clearly, this is you, and this is me. You, the one who's been questioning me, this is who you are, right? Based upon what your abilities, based upon your knowledge, based upon your creative abilities even, and this is me. He is drawing a sheer distinction. But he is also being immensely gracious. Now, we've already established Job doesn't deserve this. He's really said some awful things about God. He's accused him of wrongdoing. Have we ever done that? And even if we haven't, have we sinned? Have we offended God? Maybe you already did this morning. Is God any less gracious to us? And let's be clear, is he any more gracious to us than to Job? No. We even touched on this on Wednesday evening. God is the God of all grace. The God of all grace. And as we understand what he's doing and how he's processing Job through this, and really ultimately we're going to see restoration, he's first having to help Job understand, you need to see me for who I am. Job's not completely wrong, but he's missed some stuff. He's gotten some things in his head based upon his circumstances, and God is correcting him. He's bringing him back to where he needs to be. Next week, we are going to look at Job's first reaction to the Lord. And that's where we're going to be expanding on this a little bit. But folks, again, I hope that you've appreciated not only the really, really big picture, right? But in some ways, if we just were to relate this to different animals or to different situations, we can see all these different things around us. But ultimately, it is seeing the character of God through these things. The all-powerful, all-knowing God, who, by the way, is also the provider and the protector and the one who moves and controls. Can you trust him with your life? Now, you know, sometimes that kind of sounds like this, and I'll be finished. Somebody might say, boy, you know, if it comes to it, I have faith in the Lord, and I would die for him. Right? Isn't that what Peter said? Now take this for what it means, right? I believe that God is a lot, I shouldn't say a lot, he's less interested in whether or not we'll die for him as much as whether or not we'll live for him. And that is where sometimes we trip up. We see the big picture. Boy, if it comes down to it, listen, the next time you're tempted, it comes down to it. It's whether or not you're going to respond in faith. When God takes you through a test, it comes down to it. Because really, what did Jesus say? You need to die daily. So he brings Job back to some of the basics of life. And he says, I'm bigger than you. I'm bigger than these things. I'm bigger than what you're going through. Ultimately, trust me. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, this morning in our Bible fellowship hour, Brother Larry read a passage from the Psalms that said that you remember that we are but dust. Lord, for some reason, that is just one of my favorite verses because it just shows the graciousness, the understanding that you have for your creation, yes, but your fallen creation. You know that we are weak. You know that we struggle. You know that we will succumb to sin. You know that we are sometimes just not going to even give you the time of day. And it's hard to even pray that, Lord, and acknowledge it, but it's true. And you understand. You understand because you made us. You don't condone sin, but you understand that we are extremely finite, weak creatures, particularly in comparison to you. And as we think of the wild world out there, we know that it'd be very difficult for us to just be out there on our own and be faced with some of these things. We certainly can't manage it. So, Lord, as we think of all of these things, we just thank you for your grace. We thank you that you meet us where we are. But we also thank you that is not where you are satisfied. But you want us to be like Jesus. So, Lord, I pray that we will respond in faith, not just for that big call that might not ever come of laying our life down for you once and for all, but for heeding those everyday calls to die to self and to live for you. In Jesus' name, amen.